Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of super yachting is Sophia Wilson. Both of us are fresh from our travels and ready to report back. So how are you? How are you holding up, Sophia?
Yeah, I'm well. I'm actually quite healthy, which I think is unnerving me because everyone else seems to be dropping like flies from various bugs and COVID, etc. It seems to be sweeping the UK at the moment. But at the moment, I'm still very perky. How about you?
Hanging on in there. Yeah, the same. You know, you do fear the COVID return, but for now, hanging on in there, thriving.
I do have a bad habit of waking up feeling a bit dopey in the morning and then being like, it's probably COVID. And then I've been up for 10 minutes and I'm like, probably was just a bit tired, wasn't I?
Probably just sleep. Yeah. So obviously we were both at Super Yacht Design Festival last week, along with so many industry people. It was great to kind of see everyone after a while being separated, and great to do our first one in Milan.
Yeah, it was great to be in Milan. I actually had never been to Milan before, despite all my global travels. So it was great to see the city. And yeah, it's wonderful for the event to go ahead. I mean, we've postponed it, was it three times or maybe?
Yeah, about that.
So just great to have everyone back together. We're obviously in the Mall at Milan, which was a brilliant space. Seemed to work so well for the event, and great because it meant all the sponsors could have little areas to showcase what they were doing. And I think it was a big success.
Yeah, I loved that bit. We had this sort of designer's gallery on the entrance to the mall, which we've not done before, and really helped the companies kind of show off their best. You know, the rug company had these amazing rugs hanging up, and Techno Gym and all sorts of different brands had these kind of display stands. So it was great to see that. But talk us through, obviously it kicked off with the awards on the first night.
Yeah, so it started as traditionally it used to with the Boat Design and Innovation Awards on the, losing track of my days now, that must have been on the Wednesday evening, hosted by Shirley Robertson, which was great. The big winner of the night was Al Wab, which was our cover boat, and I'm now trying to remember, for one of our spring issues. I'll have to go back and double check which one. She took home three Neptunes, including the Outstanding Exterior Design for Motor Yachts between 40 to 59.9 metres, Best Interior Design for Motor Yachts 499 GT and below, and Best Naval Architecture for in the Displacement Motor Yachts category. So yeah, a big night for her and the Vrypak team, who were delighted. I don't know whether you've seen on LinkedIn, they've done a lovely photo of them kind of back with all the team showing off their Neptunes. So I think it was a real team effort, and I, you know, clearly meant a lot to them to be able to come back with three awards.
Yeah, I have seen it. Also a very happy video clip of them kind of clutching their various awards, but congrats to them because we know how hard they work. And I mean, exterior, interior and naval architecture, that's just an award-winning boat, isn't
it? it's a pretty good clean sweep, and they're podcast listeners as well, so full points all around.
Love them. Yeah. it is a beautiful boat though. They've managed so cleverly with the interior to make it feel kind of modern and light and airy, but it also feels quite cozy and homely and like somewhere that you really want to kind of live in, which is not easy to do, really.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a beautiful yacht. I am going to have to remember which issue it is. But we'll also, I think that feature's now online, so we'll add that link in the podcast description as well, so you can go and have a proper look at her or another look at her again if you've forgotten some of her highlights. Another winner that I wanted to pick out was the Outstanding Lifestyle Feature category, because I always think that's quite interesting. And this year was particularly interesting because the winner was the Wally Y200 for her master cabin. And I know I've definitely spoken about this on the podcast before. And it is kind of an incredible innovation that they've come up with. So the kind of what the judge had said is they were quite divided on her exterior because she is a kind of love it or hate it exterior, sort of spaceship-esque. But they were unanimous on the appeal of its master suite, calling it a star in its class. So they basically have, the model's been engineered entirely around this feature. So they unlocked extra volume by relocating all the anchor operations to the deck below and putting nothing but glass between the guests and the outdoors. So you're kind of lying in bed and you have these 270 degrees views, which for a yacht of her size is pretty remarkable. And it's also 37 square meters in total, which is probably about the size of my house, I imagine. but yeah, in a yacht that size, it's very impressive. So I thought that was another interest, well-deserved category winner.
Yeah, definitely. That's an amazing feat of engineering, really. I always loved the Lifetime Achievement Award. And this year it was Jerry Dykstra. And it's interesting compared to other years, you know, normally those speeches are very emotional, and it was, but he was quite kind of pragmatic in what he was saying, which in a way made it even more powerful. I loved what he said. He said, you know, we always say to you owners, you know, if you can build it, then you can dream it. But there's something in between dreaming and building. And that's us. That's what we do. That's, you know, working out how to make these dreams actually work on the water. And I just thought, God, that's so true. There's, you know, hundreds of people whose sole job it is to take crazy designs on bits of paper. And actually, a kind of theme that was running through the conference, I think, was that it's one thing to sketch something on a, you know, back of a cigarette packet and say, let's do this. And it's such, there's such a big jump between having a vision and making it work technically, especially in yachting. So if you're a designer that can do both of those things, which he has, and, you know, when they were kind of playing through the video of his work, they were just, you know, beautiful boat after beautiful boat. He's so gifted and so kind of modest with it, really.
Yeah, so we're actually, we've got an interview with him running in the Life Under Sail supplement, which will be in our September issue, which Marilyn Moe has done with him. And I've just been reading through and editing it a bit this week. And it's an amazing backstory. So he was studying, had an accident on the rugby field and basically had a brain injury and had to take some time away from studies and decided he wanted to do something outdoors and took a job on a charter yacht delivering a boat to the Caribbean. And kind of never really looked back from there, never went back to his studies, got really into, you know, being on the yachting scene, got into racing and kind of built his career from that. So, yeah, it's a pretty remarkable story that, you know, you think one incident like that in a way has completely kind of shaped his whole career and what he's done for the sailing yacht industry. There's no doubt, you know, with the Dyna rig and everything else, you know, yachts like Maltese Falcon, the J classes, like the sailing industry would not be what it is today without him.
Yeah. And I think they were saying he's a pretty amazing sailor himself, yeah, personally as well. You know, there were lots of pictures of him on boats looking quite windswept and like he was in his element.
Well, he's done two transatlantics, I think. I think he only made one of them, but I think even on that one, he had a problem with the mast and he had to go back to where he'd started and then went back. So he got sort of halfway across, had a problem with the mast, went back and then went back again, but still managed to finish within the time. Or yeah, it's something incredible. Anyway, that full feature will be in the Life on Sail supplement in September.
Yeah, I look forward to reading it. Sounds great. And then, so after the awards, we obviously had the Super Yacht Design Festival, the kind of two-day conference, really, and all the talks. You know, look forward to hearing what you think. But I thought the two big hits for me, one being Professor Barry Smith, who we've obviously talked about ad nauseum on this podcast. There's an episode with him, but everyone seemed to love him. You know,
he was... I'm obsessed with Professor Barry Smith to the point where my husband this weekend was like, you're actually being quite boring now.
It's one of those things that he says things that are amazing to quote at dinner parties. You know, yeah. Did you know you've got 35 senses and all this stuff? But yeah, for those of you who don't know, he is a sensory professor who's worked with the likes of Heston Blumenthal and Coca-Cola and different champagne houses and artists like Oliver Eliasson, you know, all the coolest people. And he was talking about the kinds of things that affect your senses on a super yacht and how you can change them. But it's quite tangential, his talk. At one stage he was playing, like, did you know if you listen to the different sounds of hot water being poured into a coffee cup or cold water, you can just tell by the sound? And he did it. And it's amazing. You know, your body can do stuff. It made me realize how many different signals your body is taking in all the time that you don't even realize.
No, I think, I mean, it's completely fascinating. The water thing I'd never thought about before, but then when he spoke about it, it does make sense, because something like the noise that they put in Coca-Cola adverts, obviously you associate, you know, it's a cold drink being opened without, and that must come from your sound and your understanding of your senses. And I also find it really fascinating, obviously with my daughter, who's not quite two, I'm kind of more aware of it because you watch that they can't really link senses together. Yeah. And he spoke a bit about that as well, as to particularly why children have an aversion to green things. And it's because they can't associate that bitter taste that comes with something green, and then they kind of blanket ban anything green from going anywhere near them. But yeah, it was absolutely fascinating. You so rarely stop and think about why, you know, why we act the way we do. And I do wonder, from a design perspective, you know, obviously I'm sure designers are very aware of this stuff, but so much we do concentrate just on the aesthetic, and actually it does go so many levels below that as to how you interact with the space.
Well, the yacht design things that I thought were interesting, one is he was saying, you know, focus on your kind of line of sight, like the body wants to be able to see what's in the next cabin, what's outside, what's ahead of it, which makes complete sense when you think of all these, you know, yachts at the moment with lots of glass and things. We like to see, we like to know what's coming. Essentially, he was saying that there's a sense of anticipation and you feel more comfortable and more happy if you feel like you know you know, how that step is going to feel, where this is leading. So anything you can do, any device you can come up with design wise that kind of acts as a signal to the user that this is what's coming next is a good thing.
I think I personally would find that massively helpful because I am incredibly clumsy, particularly on yachts. And I spend a lot of time bumping into things. So I think, yeah, I think I need all the help I can get.
Well, the other thing he said that I thought was quite interesting was that it's, you like visually, you like things to look like their surroundings, which I think is quite a challenge for your designers. Because if you're designing a boat that goes to the Arctic one week and the Mediterranean the next, in design terms, that doesn't really work. What he was saying is that, you know, if you're out in the Med, in the sun, you want to see blue cushions and things that reflect the water and that, you know, the glorious landscape around you, really. So if you're designing for multiple landscapes, you've got to kind of factor into your design how you make it feel like the places that you're going to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certain designers that seem to be really good at that. Someone like H2's Johnny Horsfield, for example, he always talks about the importance of drawing the eye outside, essentially. Yeah. So that if you're on a yacht, actually, you don't want to be looking at the interior. You want to be kind of drawn in by the outside. So I guess that's not, it's not matching it, but it's making sure that the interior never clashes with the surrounding scenery.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And then, you know, everyone was good, I think. But the other kind of key highlight for me was Giorgetto Giorgiaro, who we've spoken about before. Maybe we'll be lucky enough to get him on the podcast at some point in the future. But kind of legendary car designer. He's designed everything from the Fiat Panda to the Lancia. He'd designed a trimaran, which we'd never seen before, that he kind of flashed up on the screen. And he's just an absolute legend. He's 86, still rides his motorbike around the Italian mountains completely on his own. He got a standing ovation, which I thought was very well deserved. You know, we don't get those. It's quite funny. Often at our events, you see a few people stand up and not always do people follow. Sometimes there's a kind of quasi standing ovation, but everyone stood up for him because he was so impressive. And what struck me was just the pure amount of work he's done to get where he is today. Like a lot of the stories from his early career involved him, you know, working for a car company during the day, working on his own designs at night, you know, working through summer holidays, working, turning things around in incredibly quick times to get things in front of people. And he was also just talking about, you know, really driving home that in design terms, whether it's a boat or a car or a jet or a train, it's all about the maths. His father forced him to do technical drawing when he was a young student. In fact, he drove him to his appointments and made sure he got out and sat in the classroom, because I can imagine they were probably mind-numbingly boring classes when you're a young guy who wants to be out playing footy or whatever. But as a result, he's amazing at kind of technical drawing. He knows how to make things add up on paper. And I think the way he was explaining it, that's really the key to designing anything, that, you know, artists today tend to think about, you know, the creative vision first, but really you should be working backwards from the engineering so that, you know, whatever you've done on paper, it's going to work in practice. And I think that explains his huge commercial success, because he was basically saying he can design things that work in build and can be, you know, replicated in huge numbers if need be. So very, very interesting guy.
Yeah, he was remarkable and a brilliant get by you, may I say, for managing to persuade him to come and talk. And as you say, he was hugely appreciated by the audience as well. And he was on the second day, so it was a real kind of highlight of kind of coming towards the end of the conference. It was a real highlight. We are going to try and, so we recorded obviously all the talks throughout the 2 days. So we are going to try and use some of those and get them on the podcast hopefully in the coming weeks, as long as the audio's worked and we can make them make sense without the presentations and everything else going on behind them.
Yeah, definitely. If you missed it, do try and catch a few of those. And so, yeah, we did Italy last week, and then I was off again to Monaco. Monaco on Monday, no rest for the wicked.
Yeah, keeping you busy.
Keeping me busy, yeah. But that was another fantastic event. So this was for the second Ultra High Net Worth Insight Summit. So that was held at Monaco Yacht Club, and it's actually kind of run by two professors from the university who do research on ultra high net worth individuals.
The same who we had on the podcast and who spoke at the Explorer Yacht Summit.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. They're called Dr. Philip Klaus and Dr. Annalisa Tarchini-Poli, I think. But we'll try and link. There was a podcast with them that Stuart did a while back. They're really interesting guys. And the amount they know about super yacht clients, what they want, what they say they want, is fascinating. And so this summit, you know, there were lots of people from the yacht industry there, lots of people also from insurance and banking and other companies. Typically boiling hot day as it is in Monaco. Great to be in Monaco when there wasn't a show on, actually. You know, great to be sitting there in the sunshine and not be faced with huge crowds of people. But this was focusing all about, you know, the first one talked all about the kind of products that ultra high net worth people like to buy. And this one was focusing all about the experiences around the products that brands are doing. So, you know, more and more brands are creating things for their clients to get them excited about what's coming up, to keep relations with them, to, you know, give them a point of difference over their competitors. And it's really something you should be thinking about. They were saying, you know, the superyacht industry is particularly behind in this respect, that lots of builders, you know, when you say what sort of experiences do you do for your clients, they just say, well, we build boats, you know, what more do you want from us type thing. But actually that's a very backwards way of thinking, because most companies now, and, you know, the travel industry and the food and drink industry, they've been doing this kind of thing for the past 5 years, maybe at least, are permanently working on new ways to connect with their clients, new things to keep in touch. And Raphael Soulou from Fraser was there. Obviously, they've been doing a lot. He gave a great example of, he said, you know, one of the you know, going above and beyond experiences he did for their clients is in the, you know, partly through the pandemic, he had one family saying, you know, we haven't seen each other for ages, we really want to charter a yacht. And he had another family come to him saying, well, you know, we think mum and dad have chartered a boat, we want to charter a boat too. And they thought, well, hang on, this is the perfect opportunity to do something incredible. So the family that chartered the first boat had no idea that their family were coming to join them. And the way that they unveiled themselves to it is they launched a kind of pirate attack on the boat. So they were kind of motoring around wherever they were, the Med or the Caribbean. Suddenly this boat approaches, all these pirates jump on board. And of course, it's their family who they haven't seen for a number of years. So that was a kind of a great example of this kind of thing in practice. Normally the things actually before or after the point of purchase, whether it's a charter or a boat. But that was interesting. And they were also, yeah, there were sort of some key takeaways for people in the yachting industry, as well as, you know, people who are owners who own boats and are also looking at chartering them out. One thing to kind of bear in mind in terms of rising costs and difficulties is that lots of the research shows ultra high net worth individuals don't like a lack of transparency. They don't like it when they're not told everything up front. They don't like it when there's surprises around the corner. So it's much better to kind of be honest with them. It's much better to say, yep, we're going to have mounting prices, we're going to cost, you know, pass these on to you, and this is the arrangement, than to try and hide things and try and fudge it a bit. Because they were saying quite often, you know, brands, when they were asked, felt like the relationship was good, and clients actually felt like, well, actually, they didn't tell me this, you know, it's fine now, but I wish I had known, type thing. And another thing was that the post-purchase experience is, in their research, 5 times more valuable than anything you do in the lead up to or during. So, you know, it's not enough to have a great charter. You know, if you follow up with people afterwards and do something, ask them about their trip, send them something, invite them to something, that's what really cements the good work you've done at the time. So as an example of this in practice, there was this amazing travel company called Black Tomato, who were doing some bonkers experience where they took ultra high net worths and abandoned them somewhere in the world.
Yeah, so I was meant to do that experience just before COVID.
Really?
I can't remember what it's called now. They've got
Get Lost,
yeah. And they basically dump you somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you have to find your way out. I mean, I presume with some help. Yeah, it's a shame that that one never quite got off the ground, but we were talking about trying to do it because it is so applicable to ultra high net worth that they do. It's kind of a weird mixture because, like, you just said that they like knowing exactly what's happening and, you know, upfront costs, but then at the same time there is this kind of real thrill of the unknown. I guess it's how you balance those two together. But yeah, unfortunately never quite got to do that. Does sound like an amazing idea.
I can drop you somewhere in London that you don't know where you are to try and replicate the experience of somewhere on the outskirts, can drop you near an airport. But, you know, in terms of the post-purchase thing, what they do is when their clients are back home and back to reality and maybe feeling like a bit of a sort of come down off the experience, they send them a back to reality kit, which arrives as a surprise at their home and has lots of thoughtful bits of pieces in. So it's things like that. that really cement the kind of good times that people have had and encourage customer loyalty and repeat business and that kind of thing. So yeah, really interesting to meet them. And then I know that you're off next week, aren't you? And Stuart is currently in Italy.
Stuart's in Italy. So Stuart and I are slightly kind of following in each other's footsteps. So he has been with Bonetti in Italy this week. And then I am going out for the official launch of Beyond next week. But yeah, Stuart, I think, has been having a great time, according to the photos that he sent back. It looks lovely.
Well, I think the Beyond will be great as well. I'm looking forward to hearing your kind of report back from that.
Yeah, well, Stuart also had a sneak preview and he was saying it's pretty wild and it's very different but very exciting. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it in person.
So that's what's been happening in the boat world, obviously very important, but let's take a look at what's been happening in the wider world over the past couple of weeks. First up, I wanted to kind of pull out President Biden has made some comments about yachting in a press conference, quite a rambling press conference, it has to be said from the script. But what he said is, you know, if you're going out and buying a yacht, it doesn't help the economy a whole lot, which I would take issue with, I have to say, because, you know, when you look at our stats and you see the number, obviously lots of people are buying boats at the moment, but you know, there's a huge industry around that. There are hundreds of people kind of selling these boats, building these boats, making the materials that go in these boats. You know, we learned from the design festival, there's a whole crowd of kind of artisans who are making beautiful things that no one else, quite frankly, will pay for because they won't pay for the quality. So I'd argue that, you know, it does help the economy quite a bit. I think that the wider context of what he was saying, he then went on to kind of talk about the environment a bit, which wasn't directly linked. But I think he was kind of, you know, taking a pop at super yachts from an environmental point of view, which is maybe more of a fair cop. But again, what was interesting, we had a panel at the festival all about, you know, if super yachts can ever be 100% fossil free. And we had people there from Rolls-Royce, we had people there from San Lorenzo, from all different companies. And what was clear to me, it was actually quite positive in that, you know, there's a lot that we can do. The technology's there. There's all sorts of things that people are working on. And there are just a few stumbling blocks. So things like there's a shortage of green hydrogen, for example. So companies are ready to use it, but there's actually not currently enough to go around. But the takeaway for me, I think, is that super yacht owners really need to start taking more of a punt on these projects. You know, if you're an owner who wants to have a more environmentally conscious yacht, there are so many options out there for you. There are wacky concepts. There are companies that are doing these things now. It's just about actually kind of putting your money where your mouth is and getting on board with one of these projects. And some of them have kind of got stuff built in so that, okay, the technology might not be ready now, but you know, in a few years' time, if XYZ does become more available, then you can make more of a switch then. So I'd really like to see owners going more in that direction. But yeah, I don't think those comments were quite on the mark.
Yeah, I think there's two things here. I think it's hard. I think it's something industry struggles with generally, and we've seen even more over the recent months that trying to explain the industry, if you're not in it or you don't see it every day and you don't understand the full kind of depth that goes into it, both in terms of, you obviously talked about a lot of the artisans and the crafts and all that side, but also just in terms of crew and the sheer numbers of people that the industry employs. And I think it's very easy just to see these, you know, big yachts on the water and think that it's only a handful of very wealthy people enjoying them, but actually it is a huge industry underneath that is that is supporting it, and that has to be a good thing for the economy. And then kind of on the green side of things, I think, yeah, it is just a matter of time. And I think it is a bit of a chicken and egg situation, because obviously the more investment goes into the technologies, the quicker these will improve and the more realistic they will become as kind of viable options. But equally at the same time, the first few are likely going to need improvements or tweaks or modifications, and also likely to be more expensive. So I think it's quite a difficult balance at the moment as to how you make it worthwhile for owners to really want to invest in that technology. And, you know, it will change. And ultimately, sadly, it may well change because tariffs around normal fossil fuels and the price of fossil fuels will get to a point that actually these green technologies economically become a better option. But I think we're a little way off that. So at the moment, yeah, it does take some brave owners to really decide to push the boundaries of what's possible.
Yeah, definitely. And then other news was that I've seen this horrific picture. I feel like I've seen a video, but I'm not sure about that, of this yacht in Turkey sinking.
Yeah, so it's a 26 metre. We think it's called Capcai, but we're just trying to get confirmation of that. So it's sort of sunk off western Turkey. There are believed to be 10 people on board, and they were all rescued by the Coast Guard, and thankfully no one was hurt, which is obviously the most important thing. Again, we'll add the link to it. The photos are, you know, it looks sort of 50% submerged. But there has been a salvage mission, and our understanding is that the yacht has been kind of prevented from sinking all the way to the ocean floor, which is obviously a good thing environmentally. So hopefully at some point she can be towed back, and I'm not sure whether she'll be rescuable, but probably better than sinking fully. But how they've achieved that, given the photo I've seen of how submerged she is, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, it doesn't look good.
Always, always sad to see a yacht in that kind of distress.
Mm. Well, good that everyone got off safely at least.
And finally, I just wanted to flag, love it or hate it, but Below Deck is back. So Bravo, who are the television network that look after it, have confirmed the return of the Below Deck spin-off series, Below Deck Mediterranean, which will be the seventh series, I believe, of Below Deck Med. So they've just finished filming in Malta, with the new series starting on July the 11th, so that's week after next. Below Deck fans, be pleased to hear that Captain Sandy is back at the helm. I know Stuart in particular is a fan of Captain Sandy. And they're actually filming this time on board the 50-metre motor yacht Home, which was built by Heesen in 2017. So she's quite a well-known yacht. I was kind of surprised that she was being used, but yeah, I mean, great exposure obviously for the yacht. She's currently available for charter with Burgess, from $245,000 a week. And she's also jointly listed for sale with Burgess and Christie Yachts, asking $29.5 million. So if you watch the show and you like her, she's available. But I'm sure it will once again highlight the drama of the industry, or certain aspects of the industry.
I feel like I had a look at Heesen's Home because I've written about it and heard about it before, and I refreshed my memory this morning, and all I can say, not being a huge Below Deck fan myself, is that she certainly has all the ingredients for a bit of drama on board. Largely, there's a sit-up bar shaded by a hard top, as well as a jacuzzi and a dancing pole. I feel like the jacuzzi plus dancing pole plus bar, you know,
that trailer just makes itself.
Yeah, exactly. That leads itself to something else. And then there's also, you know, it says another spot for riotous evenings is the Sky Lounge, which is in effect an extension of the outside deck with beanbags, daybeds, and teak flooring. Space is serviced by a bar and a popular spot for lounging and taking the view. Alternatively, the doors to the aft deck can be shut, the fence removed, a mirror ball and a smoke machine can be added, and the area becomes a dedicated party room. So it sounds like they have all the, you know, the stages set for a bit of, a bit of partying, really.
Yeah, well, Holly, our lovely online editor, is the biggest Below Deck fan in the office. So I'm sure as soon as it's airing, I will get regular, I should probably try and watch some of it myself, but I tend to get regular updates from her as to exactly what's going on. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, we look forward to that. Should we take a look at the news?
Yeah, should we do some proper news?
some actual news. Well, maybe I'll kick us off with another Heesen. Actually, the brand new 49.98-metre Heesen superyacht Bookends has been spotted undertaking sea trials in the North Sea. Now, this is going to be a challenge for my pronunciation. Now berthed in Hellevoetsluis. Do you reckon that's right?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
The yacht is expected to see delivery soon. She marks the second unit from the Dutch Yard's 5000 aluminium series, following in the footsteps of 2021 delivery Aquamarine. The yacht boasts a gross tonnage of 499 and has been constructed entirely in aluminium, as the name would suggest. Exterior design comes from Frank Laupman and the team at Omega Architects, who have given her a sharply tapered bow, distinctive boot stripe and arching aft decks. Interiors come from Cristiano Gatto and offer accommodation for 12 guests in 5 cabins, plus further accommodation for a complement of 9 crew. The yacht was sold under the project name Sapphire, with Tom Conboy handling the sale. She was sold in the third quarter of 2021 to a repeat Heesen client who previously owned a 47-metre superyacht launched under the same name, clearly a Heesen fan.
Yeah, so next on the list, we have that the 70-metre Nova's Crew Project 795 has been spotted for the first time as she moves from Kiel to Rendsburg for the final stages of construction. Project 795 features both interior and exterior design from the drawing boards of Winch Design. Her exterior is characterised by flare bow, angled portholes and a strong hull line. Onboard highlights are thought to include a generous sun deck with a large pool, an ample swim platform. Pictures also suggest that there's an aft-deck pool and a tender garage in the bow, but we don't actually know that much about the build at this stage. The last time the yacht was spotted was in October 2020, when she moved to Kiel for the installation of her technical systems. So we think the yacht is on track for delivery later this year. She's obviously kind of one of the projects that has been slightly caught with obviously Nobis Krug and the financial situation, but they're obviously now back up and running. So it'll be great when she finally properly is delivered next year.
Well, we look forward
to that. Later this year, even. Don't have to wait till next year.
Yeah.
Later this year, I apologise.
Obviously, you can take a look, first look on our site now, which is great. So yeah, check it out. Next up is the news that 73-metre Lursen superyacht Coral Ocean, lots of first looks this week, has also been pictured for the first time following a major €35 million refit. Delivered as Coral Ocean by Lursen in 1994, the legendary John Ballenberg was responsible for her exterior profile. The yacht cruised privately for most of her life until she changed hands in 2019 and was purchased by Australian entrepreneur Ian Maloof, who embarked on a no-expense-spared refit at the Astilleros de Mallorca shipyard. Coral Ocean made her post-refit debut at the 2022 Monaco Grand Prix, so if you were there, you might have had a look, and is now available for Mediterranean charters with the Ahoy Club. We spent just 1 week on Coral Ocean straight after purchasing her at the 2019 Monaco Yacht Show, which was the fastest sale in superyacht history, and this gave us enough time to decide that we were going to completely transform her, said Maloof. The pandemic has served us a good period of time to rebuild the yacht with no shortcuts. What could have been made a challenging task managing the rebuild via video from Australia was almost seamless by our fantastic team on the ground in Parma and awesome technology. Well, that is quite a feat, refitting a yacht to that extent from that far away. But sounds like they've done a fantastic job of it. Yeah, great to see.
Yeah, I caught up with his daughter when they're in London earlier this year, and she was talking about some of the challenges they've had as to effectively doing a refit via Zoom, the whole process. But the results are pretty outstanding. Have a look. She obviously, has been back, as I said there. She was at the Monaco Yacht Show, but this is the first time we've been able to actually get hold of those interior pics to show. And I know hopefully the plan is to do a kind of bigger feature at some stage, talking about all the work they've done, because it is a spectacular refit that they've undertaken. So finally, I thought we'd end with a good news story, something to warm the heart. So a 34-metre classic yacht has been saved by McMillan Yachts in Rhode Island after narrowing avoiding a scheduled demolition in California. The yacht called Mamere, which was operating as a harbour cruise ship under the name High Spirit, has been saved by the president of McMillan Yachts, Earl McMillan III. McMillan was able to introduce a new party that was interested in saving the vessel and was integral to arranging the transfer of the boat from California to Rhode Island. McMillan Yachts will now helm a full-scale restoration from the keel up with a view to restoring her to her classic charms. She was first launched in 1929 and was designed by John Trumphrey and built by the Matthias Yacht Building Company. So there's some lovely photos of her kind of on a transport vessel being moved across. But I mean, she already had, so because she was so close, it feels a bit like she was on death row. Because the yacht was so close to being demolished, they'd already kind of cut out her engines. So she had these sort of gaping holes in the side of her. But she looks like she could be really beautiful. So it'd be nice to see.
It is amazing how many incredible boats, are close to demolition or are just found kind of abandoned. Like, I'm always surprised to hear, when I found this, it was, in the mud somewhere and abandoned. And great, apart from anything else, from an environmental point of view, we shouldn't just be leaving these boats to die. Great that someone, good on Earl McMillan III for rescuing her.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll keep you updated as that story progresses, I'm sure. Although I expect she's got a couple hard years of work ahead of her.
Yeah, definitely. So on to the data. And for this week's data story, as ever, brought to you by our fantastic market intelligence platform, Boat Pro, we're looking actually at what I presented at the Monaco Ultra High Net Worth Insights Summer earlier this week. I've had a couple of messages from people asking for a copy of the report of what I talked about. So I thought actually we could pull out a few of the key stats here. So essentially, as I mentioned earlier, the conference was looking at what ultra high net worth individuals want and how that's changed. So as a starting point, I thought, well, let's take stock a bit and look at how the ultra high net worth superyacht owning client has changed, especially over the past few years. And the first thing to say that we know for sure is that the ultra high net worth client is getting younger across the board, but this is definitely true in the superyacht world. So, for example, yacht builder San Lorenzo said recently that the average age of their client has dropped from over 60 to 48. And according to the Knight Frank Wealth Report, by 2025, 45% of the world's wealthiest people should be younger than 45 years old. I find that just a staggering statistic, you know, under 45, so young. And it does feed back into what we've heard this from yacht owners for a while now, which is, you know, at 60, they used to be the young kid on the block at the marina, but that is not the case anymore. Yacht owners are getting younger and younger. In fact, it's currently estimated that 129,557 ultra net worths are self-made and under the age of 40. So almost a fifth of the total population.
It's quite scary. We need to get a wiggle on, Charlotte. Scary.
Yeah, I'm realizing now my years to become an ultra high net worth are running away from me quickly. And then I thought, well, let's have a look at what does this kind of, we've got this younger self-made demographic, you know, from what I hear from people, there's a lot of tech money, there's a lot of pharma money coming in. What does that actually mean for the yachting industry in terms of how they operate? And the main takeaway is that these younger clients want things faster. And if you want proof of this, you only have to look at how we've seen the semi-custom market boom in recent years. So we took a look at, if you look at between 2010 and 2020, so really today, 77.7% of the world's super yachts are semi-custom. If you look back to the 90s, you know, between 1990 and 1999, this was much, much lower. It was about 54.2%. So essentially, it marks a shift between, you know, owners who want to design every door handle and cabin in their super yacht, and they're prepared to wait a few years plus to make their, you know, their dream creation to come to light, to people who just want the boat and fast, and, you know, they're prepared to go for something pretty tried and true, something that they know is reliable. They'll personalize it to a certain extent, but what's important for them is taking ownership of it really quickly. Speaking to Raphael from Fraser, he was saying that deals are going through more quickly than they have been in the past over this period. And it's something actually that the university researchers Annalise and Philip have noted about experiences, in that owning a yacht is less of a status thing for people than it used to be. It's less about showing everyone, look, I have a yacht, and more about, you know, it's a transaction. They want to have the yacht so that they can travel with their family, so that they can travel at a time when travel is very difficult if you're flying or if you're going by land. So it doesn't make sense for these people to wait longer for a boat than they have to. What they really want is to get those experiences, which means they want the boat quickly. So good news for you if you're a refit yard or a builder that can turn them around quite quickly, probably represents a bit of a challenge for other people in the industry. We also took a look at our global order book figures, and I had a big kind of chart showing, you know, if you look at the numbers of yachts in build, you know, going up and up over the past 10 years or so, but also the number of semi-customs is creeping up as well, in sync with that. And then the next thing we took a look at was destinations. You know, I was wondering, okay, if super yacht owners are more motivated by experiences, does that mean they're going to more ambitious places? And the answer is not necessarily. If you take a look, you know, it's still the traditional, more recently popular yachting destinations that are doing really well. If you look at places like Saint-Tropez, there were 500 yachts there back in 2018, sorry. Last year, there were 739. Or Porto Cervo, for example, more of a recently established one, but 165 yachts were there in 2018. 284 were there last year. We know that Monaco had a stellar turnout for the Grand Prix this year, which we talked about on a previous podcast. And there are some kind of newer destinations, places like Bodrum. In 2018, there were 70 yachts there, 184 there last year, which is pretty incredible. Or Porto Montenegro, there were 94 yachts there in 2018, 354 this year. Or even places like Alaska, you know, 54 yachts there in 2018, 67 there in 2021. And that's, you know, given all the difficulties of the pandemic around adventure travel. But basically what this shows us is that even though ultra high net worth super yacht owners are driven to experiences, that doesn't necessarily mean new places. You know, they might go off the beaten track for a bit. They'll go off and have adventures in places like Alaska, but essentially they'll return to where they know afterwards. So actually what they really want is experiences, new experiences in places that aren't new to them. So in places like Monaco or the Med or the Caribbean. So that's something to think about if you work in this industry. But really the takeaway from the whole thing for me is that the yacht business is lagging a bit behind here. You know, if you look at lots of other companies, they've been working on how they can get client retention by offering these kind of experiences for a long time. And lots of people in the yacht industry, you know, business has been good and they've not been thinking in this way. But they need to if they want to stay ahead of a curve, because inevitably when the superyacht industry and the superyacht market cools somewhat, it's going to become more competitive. And the people that have been really fostering and nurturing those client relationships are the ones that will most likely do the best out of that. And I was asking Raphael from Fraser, you know, when does the client journey end? You know, if you're sending people nice invitations to champagne tastings or experiential events, or you're sending them beautiful coffee table books in the post, how long do you do it for? Do you stop after 5 years? Do you stop after 10? Do you, after 15 years, say, okay, let's wipe them from the list? And he just said, never. It's really important not to bombard people, but you want to be permanently, actively inviting them to things, meeting them at things, keeping in touch with them, because he had numerous examples of people who after 15, 20 years of radio silence, they suddenly think, actually, you know, I do want a boat. And who is it I want to get a boat from? And if you've not been in touch with them, they'll think, oh, I used to do stuff with Fraser, but I haven't heard from them for a while. Let's see who else is there. But if you've been actively maintaining that relationship with that client, they're more likely to say, you know what? I've heard from Fraser the past 15 years. Let's see what they're doing.
I think as well, wealth obviously fluctuates, doesn't it? So there'll be periods when people potentially are not in a position to be purchasing or charting and look to do that, but you don't know when that's gonna change and that circle's gonna come back round. I interviewed a really great owner who's gonna be in our September issue, Doug Rostello, and he's the owner of Preference 19. And I mean, he has never owned, he's sailed in America's Cups, is a sailing fanatic, but has never owned a motor yacht, and then went to Cannes yacht show, walked the docks, fell in love with this yacht, bought it, it's loving it. But you know, he's an example of someone that probably had been on people's radars, but suddenly found himself in a position in life, was stepping away a bit from his company and suddenly thought, yeah, actually I want to do this. But that might have been 20 years of building that relationship to get to that point.
Definitely. And there was also a lot of talk about family relationships. You know, if your father went to, or mother went to Fraser events for years and years and years, well, the likelihood is, as the child of those people, you'll have that brand kind of in your consciousness. And the other thing is that, you know, and this rings true from what a lot of owners have told me as well, is that lots of brands, and I think yacht brands are really guilty of this, kind of confuse, you know, what gets ultra high net worths excited with kind of these very outdated luxury tropes of, oh, it's champagne, it's cocktail parties, it's, you know, supercars. You know, maybe people like these things, maybe they don't. You know, you're dealing with people on an individual basis. And what came out of it was that actually what people love is education. They love to learn about things they never knew. So, you know, we spoke to Perrier Jouet, who do a lot with cognac, and they arrange for people to go to the chateau where the cognac is made and speak to the maker, who no one, you know, you would just not be able to access otherwise. Or there are kind of educational cultural events and things, little talks and dinners where people come away from it not saying, wow, that was great champagne, but saying, wow, I learned something that I never expected to. And that's what, you know, that's what they really value. And that's what they're excited to attend. So a bit of homework for the week ahead. If you're listening, if you're looking to charter your boat or sell a boat, you know, you need to start putting in the hard miles with the people who might be your customers. Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week, as ever, with all the news and data from the Superyacht World and our big boat interview, of course, which goes out every Monday.
Yes, that's right. Thanks for tuning in. This episode of Boat Briefing was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you soon.